afternoon is Louise Anthony, who is a professor of philosophy at UMass Amherst. She is an expert in the philosophy of mind and feminist theory and has edited several influential books, including A Mind of One's Own, Feminist Essays on Reason and Objectivity. She'll be speaking to us today on the topic of why are there so few women in philosophy, as we see the perfect storm.
Thank you.
Dreaming, welcoming. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. This is going to be a methodological paper, by which I mean it's all speculation. There are no actual data, but maybe somebody can supply some. It would be great if they went in the right direction. The problem is one that philosophers are familiar with. Maybe not everyone here is. Women are really seriously underrepresented in philosophy. A hand count from the Philosophy Gourmet Report, which is what has become a standard sort of documenting and rating website in philosophy. Hand count in 2006, two different ones done by Buckwalter and Stitch and one done by Sally Hasinger, yielded numbers of 18.7%, 19.5% of the people employed at full-time, I guess, at universities and colleges in the United States, philosophers, that few were women. 2009, Buckwalter and Stitch did another count, and they got 25.4%. If you look at the UK, Helen Beebe had some, at the time that I got this data from her, they were preliminary. In 2010, the percentage was 22.3 in the UK. So that's well below half. Fewer than 30% of the PhDs in philosophy went to women in 2009, so it's not entirely, there's something of a pipeline problem, though that can't explain everything. But at any rate, so the question is, why does philosophy look like this? Well, one explanation that has been offered, since the late 70s and 80s, has been put forward, is that there's something about philosophy and something about women that makes philosophy alienating to women, that makes women experience philosophy as alienating. Now, there have been people who have put forward this hypothesis who have drawn the conclusion that women are defective. So Immanuel Kant, in an infamous essay called On the Distinction Between the Beautiful and the Sublime, had this to say about the relationship between scholarship and femininity. The fairer sex is nearly incapable of principle. Even if a woman excels in arduous learning and painstaking thinking, she will exterminate the merits of her sex. A woman who has a head full of Greek, like Madame Dacier, or who carries on fundamental controversies about mechanics, like the Marquise de Châtelet, might as well have a beard. The fair can leave Descartes his vortices to whirl forever without troubling themselves about them. Now, the good news here is that there were enough women that were engaged in this kind of activity for Kant to be threatened by it. Okay, but another way that you could spin the same basic explanation, that is that there's something about philosophy and women that makes one alienate, makes it alienating to women, is to say that it's philosophy where the defect lies. And this has been popular among feminist philosophers, women philosophers and also women who work on feminist topics. So Janice Moulton, in an influential paper in the 80s, argued that philosophy's use of what she called the adversarial method, that being adopted as a sort of informal cultural norm within philosophy, we argue with each other, we try to find the fault in each other's arguments. She argued that encourages intransigence among the people who are taking up these positions, and it discourages understanding. It also, she argued, makes philosophy alienating to women, who are by and large less inclined to engage in sort of adversarial interactions and who are less comfortable when it's going on. But Moulton wanted to argue not only that there was this explanation for the dissonance between women's sense of how things should go and how philosophy is doing them, but she thought that the effects of this adversarial method were actually detrimental to philosophy's central goal, which was to find out the truth. Naomi Scheman and Jennifer Hornsby, in different ways, have argued that various kinds of reductionist positions that have been enjoyed a lot of mainstream support within philosophy are creating a culture and a climate and a body of content that women are going to find alien. They argue again in different ways that reductionist paradigms privilege masculine psychological or cognitive perspectives. And Scheman draws on some work in object relations theory to suggest that these different cognitive perspectives exist. Hornsby refers to some of the same literature. Alison Jagger, Lorraine Cove, Linda Alcoff, and many, many others have argued that a framework of abstract individualism is going to make philosophy not only not so good, but alienating to women. They argue that the abstract individualist framework that says, now what is it for a knower to know, a knower S to know a proposition P, without paying any attention to who the knower is, what circumstances they're in when they are said to know this, and so forth and so on. These philosophers argue that this is not just an innocent idealization, but that the tendency to idealize in this way, that is to idealize away from various kinds of economic and material privilege that the theorists might enjoy, or to be ignorant or intolerant of diversity of various sorts, that these things make philosophy significantly less rich than it could be, and also invalidate some of the very general universal conclusions philosophers come to. Okay, recently, a couple of years ago, this paper first started circulating, a paper by Wesley Buckwalter and Stephen Stitch called Gender and Philosophical Institution Intuition, has embodied this kind of approach in a new way. Buckwalter and Stitch make the following claim. First, that there exist gender differences in the responses that people give to thought experiments. I don't know my audience. Is everybody familiar with the notion of a thought experiment? Is it anybody want me to go over that? Okay. So they claim to have data that there are gender differences in the way people judge the questions that they're asked to respond to in philosophical thought experiments. And then they speculate that these gender differences might contribute to or might explain a lot of the low rate of women in philosophy. And the mechanism that they hypothesize is that orthodox intuitions might be necessary for advancing or being told that you're doing well in a philosophy curriculum. And if that's the case, women are going to be selected out. Okay, now this kind of move, first the claim that gender differences exist, and then the interpretation of that in a way that argues that there's something defective about the domain in which the gender differences have been noticed, is something that is very strongly identified with the psychologist Carol Gilligan. Her work was motivated by what appeared to be at the time gender differences in intuitions about a particular moral thought experiment, and this is the case of Heinz in the Kohlberg paradigm. Would anybody like me to go over that? Okay. Kohlberg wanted to investigate moral development through childhood, and he did this by asking children questions about a particular thought experiment, and then he wasn't interested in whether they said how they actually answered the question in the thought experiment. It was more the kinds of considerations they adduced. So the situation was that Heinz has a very ill wife. There's a drug that will save her life, but the druggist who has the drug is charging an enormous amount of money for it, and Heinz can absolutely not afford to pay it, just can't get the money together. So the question is, would Heinz be justified in robbing the pharmacist to get the drug to save his wife's life? Now, Gilligan attacked the way Kohlberg wanted to scale moral development. So Kohlberg, for example, said that you're on a lower scale of moral development if you simply cited conventional rules as the justification for your answer. So if somebody just said, no, you shouldn't steal the drug, stealing is wrong. That gave you a lower score. You got a higher score if you, say, recited the categorical imperative and explained how that bore in this particular situation. Got a very high score. Apparently, Kant and Rawls were tried in absentia and found to be at a very high level of moral development. I don't know if that's true. The kinds of things that got you a high score was some kind of citation of a general principle or some kind of reference to the universalizability of the reasoning that you were using. The things that got you lower score were not only citing conventional things, but simply talking about the emotional relationships and the affective relationships among the participants. So, well, Heinz must love his wife very much. He ought to steal the drug because he loves her so much. That would get you a lower score. Now, Gilligan rejected the conclusion, which was not a conclusion that Kohlberg ever came to, by the way. She rejected the conclusion that you might have drawn if you saw these differences in scores, that girls were not as morally mature as boys, and instead faulted the test. Her diagnosis was that the test was identifying two distinct ethical perspectives, one she called justice, one she called care. The justice perspective was concerned with rules and universalizability and impartiality. The care perspective was concerned with preserving and fostering morally important psychological and affective relationships. Gilligan said that the Kohlberg test really was only sensitive to the justice perspective. It was just testing along that dimension and didn't give any points for people who were pretty mature in the way they applied the care perspective. Then she made the further claim that the justice perspective was masculine, and that the care perspective was feminine. Okay, and let's leave aside for a moment how that claim gets operationalized. Okay, so you get a similar theme if we go back to the philosophical critics and the philosophers who are trying to talk about what it is about philosophy that makes it alienating to women. You can read Moulton as saying that philosophy is gendered in employing the adversarial method with respect to its content, insofar as it endorses individualism, and insofar as it privileges a male psychological or cognitive style that's going to be more easy for men to sort of employ and adopt than women. Now, what you need in order to run an explanation of this sort, which I'm going to call, in honor of Gilligan, a different voices type of explanation. One of the things that you have to do to make this work is you have to presume the existence of substantive, intrinsic gender differences. That is, differences that exist independently of the situation in which they're supposed to be operative, that exist antecedently to people's experience with philosophy. So women, if women are in fact uncomfortable with aggressive conversational situations, that on this model has to be something that they bring to the encounter, the first encounter with philosophy. Okay, what I want to do in this talk is articulate and argue for the utility of a different way of approaching the question of why there are gender differences in philosophy. I want to propose, and it's not that I'm the first person to have this idea or the only person or anything like that. In fact, it's the perspective that I think is in fact employed by Virginia Valley and Sally Haslinger, Jenny Saul, and many others. But the basic move is to take the underrepresentation of women in philosophy as an interaction effect. Consider that this interaction effect is an interaction among various forms of discrimination that we already know antecedently are operative in a lot of different contexts, and the philosophy context. Now, the trick here, I think, is to explain the apparently sui generis character of philosophy, not as something that tells us something substantive about the domain of philosophy in interaction with women, but shows what looks like a special kind of discrimination as an artifact of one or both of two mechanisms. The first mechanism I'm going to call convergence, and the second mechanism I'm going to call intensification. And this isn't a rigid framework. This is mainly for heuristic purposes. But what I wanted to evoke was the two different things that can contribute to what is literally a perfect storm. So if you read Sebastian Younger's book, you know that the perfect storm that he was referred to in the title of his book involved several storm fronts meeting at a particular place where the actual geology of that meeting site intensified the form. So you had both a convergence of two or I think there were three storm systems involved, and the intensification of being located at that site. So this is this model I'm going to call the perfect storm model. Okay, so why is philosophy different? Now, this way of thinking about things in my own personal biography owes a lot to a legal theorist named Kimberly Crenshaw, who wrote on a phenomenon that she called intersectionality. So intersectionality is a model of social identity that treats the factors that contribute to the formation of social identity or the existence of social identity, maintenance of social identity, as axes in a multidimensional space. Sexism and racism are then vectors in that space, and your position in the multidimensional space is going to be affected by all these different vectors. So this model, I think, explains how sexism can have different effects on white women from the effects it has on black women, or how racism can have different effects on black women from the effects it has on black men. And the contrast here is with what Elizabeth Spelman called deridingly the pop beat model of oppression, which says you've got all these different beats. There's the racism beat, and there's the sexism beat. And if you put those two together, then you've got the social position of black women. But of course, if you want to know what a woman is like just in herself, then you've got to have a woman who doesn't have any other beads, right? So you get a white woman, so it's not messed up with race. Similarly, if you want to know what a human being is like, you don't want to messed up with gender, so you just get a man. So the idea that there's a sort of default generic human being, and then these other factors are added as substantive additions, right? That's wrong. That's what I agree with Spelman is wrong. Okay, so now what's going to follow are a bunch of speculations on my part based on a lot of anecdotal evidence. In some cases, there's some real evidence, but really I'm mostly just speculating here. So suppose we all know that stereotype threat exists, we all know that implicit bias exists. What happens if they come together? Well, here we have just your average, ordinary two philosophers having a conversation in the hall. Now, what are the factors that are in play here? Well, there are very few women, as you saw in philosophy. So stereotype threat is something that we're going to have an eye open about. But the other thing is that women are stigmatized, or I claim there's some implicit bias against women as being good at formal or analytical tasks, particularly tasks that involve symbols, particularly symbols that involve superscripts and subscripts, right? Okay, now another assumption, and that is that when you hear a new idea, when you hear an idea that you don't initially understand, there are at least two possibilities. One might be that the idea is just wacko, it doesn't make any sense. Another idea is that it makes perfect sense and there's some deficiency in you, you're not quite understanding it. But the phenomenology can be exactly the same. So it's going to be a matter of how you interpret the phenomenology. So if you've got an implicit bias that women are not very good at formal stuff, then if a woman says something that you don't understand initially, one of your reaction is going to be to not understand it. And what might happen as a consequence of your noticing you don't understand it is that the implicit bias might kick in. Right? She is a girl. And so what you might conclude at that point is that she's the one that doesn't understand something, and what she really needs is some remediation. She needs to know some basic facts. You just need to get straight at that. You know, how's the woman going to experience this? Well, she knows that 2 and 2 is 4, so she's pretty puzzled about why she's getting this information, and she's getting a little anxious because this isn't going well, and maybe stereotype gets evoked. And now, well, she's lost the thread of the conversation for one thing. For another thing, she's now maybe experiencing whatever decrement to performance goes along with stereotype threat. And she says something that really doesn't make sense. And then the stereotype is confirmed for him and for her. So this is a mechanism that I postulate might go on in some philosophy, some halls of philosophy in our country. Okay, what about intensification? Now here's what we would expect is that in the first case I was arguing that philosophy might afford a particular kind of site where the convergence of implicit bias and stereotype threat can have a sort of larger than you would have expected effect. Intensification is going to be a case where some kind of form of discrimination that exists everywhere somehow is made worse by its happening in philosophy. Okay, so this is philosophy. This is David's portrait of the death of Socrates. By the way, as Graham was talking and mentioning the effect of pictures, in my department, when you come up to the landing on the stairs just before you go into the office, you see a reproduction of David's Death of Socrates, and there are a whole bunch more people, and they're all white, and they're all men. So I'm thinking that some kind of postmodern artistic guerrilla intervention might be called for. Okay, so let's suppose that this is the stereotype of a philosopher. Now, there are a lot of things in philosophy departments that are not doing philosophy that have to be done. I think of them as, well, there's the administrative stuff, and then there's also what I think of as housework, right? Who's going to set up the reception after the speaker? Who's going to make sure that the people that come to the talk that aren't philosophers get to have somebody to talk to? There's just going to be a whole lot of sort of caretaking stuff that has to go on all the time, right? Well, men in general don't do this sort of work in society at large. Women do. So if a guy does it in a philosophy department, it might be salient, and he might actually get some special points for doing it. It's like dads that take their kids to the playground. Oh, you're such a good dad. You do this thing one day a week, but your wife does 6 days a week. Anyway, it's not always like that. But now what happens for a woman? Well, again, she's going to be instantiating a stereotype every time she does this sort of work. But the other thing is, and here's why I think philosophy might be an intensifier, philosophy departments tend to be much smaller than other departments. So for a given talk, there are fewer people to arrange the socializing afterwards. And it's also the case that, and here we can be a victim of our own success, people might feel that it's very important to have women's representation on a lot of committees. So we may be called on to do more committee work in a department like philosophy, where there are a very small number of women to go around. So it may be that for women in philosophy, the percentage of the work that they do may increase. It also may be the case that the percentage of any given woman's time that's devoted to doing that work increases. But moreover, in philosophy, and this is a speculation, and you all can let me know if you think it's plausible, I think philosophers, more than people across the academy, devalue this kind of work. They not only think it's without value, they think that the people that do it must not be that good at other things. Speculation. What I ought to do to at least have some data backing this up is to look at the rate of participation of philosophers in sort of university governance organs, who goes to graduation to represent the department and so forth. My sense is, partly from a lot of chairs, a lot of different institutions saying, would you go to graduation and look bad if nobody from philosophy is there? My sense is that the devaluation of service work is stronger in philosophy than it is elsewhere. Also, in philosophy, there's much more of a contrast between service work and the stuff that we think of as intellectually core. There is scut work to do in other departments. Susan Carey, a psychologist married to a philosopher named Block, said to me once that she didn't understand what philosophers did when they were blocked, because she's always got some scut work to do. But philosophers, we don't have data, well, some of us have data to plot, but most of us don't have data to plot or Some of the historians have texts to look at, but a lot of philosophy is just sitting and thinking. So there's an even more stark contrast between these two kinds of labor. Okay, just some more speculations. I suspect that there's a very serious conflict between the disciplinary norms of philosophy, what makes you a good philosopher in the eyes of your peers, and norms about gender, what makes you a good woman in the eyes of your peer. Now, what I want to mention here is a contrast between my model and between the perfect storm model and the different voices model. The different voices model has to predict that the more closely a woman resembles the stereotypical man, the better she's going to do in philosophy. So that more aggressive women are going to look more like men. And that if you look at the range of women who try to get academic jobs, that you'll be able to account for the variance according to how tolerant they are, how much they engage in adversarial behavior. The perfect storm does not make that prediction. It says whatever the difference between women who are comfortable with combative situations and women who are not, they're going to pattern differently than men who are comfortable with combative situations and men who are not. So a woman who is interrupted, you know, when I was in graduate school, I got the impression that the disciplinary norm was, if you feel like saying something, you just say it, whether anybody's talking or not. That's what I observed around me. But I didn't seem to get the same reactions as people that as men. So in at least the perfect storm model predicts that there might very well be equally bad consequences for women who conform to the disciplinary stereotype, and for the women who don't, they'll just be different consequences, different bad consequences. Okay, now another thing, and here again I'm just sort of revealing my self-loathing as a philosopher probably, but there's such a thing as overconfidence bias, people who overrate their ability to perform certain tasks. I suspect it's really like an occupational hazard in philosophy. I think that we have tremendous overconfidence bias, that we think we're smarter than everybody else, and we're objective than other people, and we're immune to implicit bias. And here I just need to be informed, but every time I've tried to bring up problems about implicit bias, I've had a couple of colleagues, and this is reliably at many different institutions, say that they know that this sort of thing exists, but they're trained philosophers. They're not going to fall for this, right? They don't take it, you know, like Stephen Colbert's, I don't see race. They don't, you know, philosophers don't see race. They don't see gender. So this strikes me as sort of a textbook for as a diagnostic of overconfidence bias, thinking that it's true for everybody else, but not for me. Okay, so what I've been doing then is articulating what I think of as two different models for how you would approach the question of why there are so few women in philosophy. The different voices model says that philosophy is gendered, and I looked at three sets of claims of this sort. And it requires the existence of substantive, intrinsic, antecedent gender differences. Let me say a word about intrinsic. By intrinsic, I mean roughly things that are inside the skin. I don't mean to be saying anything about the etiology of these differences. So an intrinsic difference could be the result of social interactions or interactions with the environment. So it doesn't have to be natural in any etiological sense, and it doesn't have to be immutable either. There's no modal assumption. But it just has to be something that the person carries along with her as she goes into these new situations. The perfect storm model theorizes the philosophy situation as an interaction effect, and it is going to explain, I contend, the apparently sui generis character of philosophy, that it's an artifact of a unique pattern of convergence and intensification. Let me just return to the Kimberly Crenshaw example for a moment. There was something I forgot to offer this elaboration. She was concerned as a lawyer and a legal theorist about a pattern of cases in which black women were losing discrimination suits, lawsuits. And they were losing them on the for the following reason. judges would look at the pattern of, I think Sears Roebuck was one of the cases, was one of the employers that was sued. The judges would look at the patterns of promotion of black people and say, no racial discrimination here. They'd look at the patterns of promotion of women and they'd say, no gender discrimination here. But what they were missing was that the black people who were being promoted were men, and that the white women, that the women who were being promoted were white. So they didn't have a model for explaining how there could be, without, as they saw it, any evidence of racial discrimination, any evidence of gender discrimination, how could there be discrimination against black women? And one thing you might think is, well, okay, so there has to be a third kind of discrimination, discrimination against just race, just gender, and discrimination against race plus gender. I think that's the wrong way of doing it, rather than fragmenting into all these different kinds of discrimination conforming to or corresponding to all the different kinds of intersectional identities people can have. If you think of the if you think of racism and sexism as vectors, then you can explain the apparently sui generis effect on black women without having to hypothesize the social identity or the form of discrimination. Okay. So my question is, which model should we choose? You might think, why do we have to choose? Maybe they're both correct, right? They don't have to be in competition, or there could be a little of both. You might think, we shouldn't choose. There's so little known about this, and not very much evidence on either side. We shouldn't take sides. It's premature. But I want to argue that we do need to choose. I think the programs, the two different models, entail different programs of research, and our resources are limited. And I also think that pursuing the perfect storm in a condition where you have to choose is the one to choose because it has a higher expected utility. So I want to be really clear. This slide is really for the benefit of audiences who are not here. But I want to be really clear what I'm advocating here. I'm not saying that it would be a socially bad thing and I'd hate it and I'd be really unhappy if it were true that the different voices model was correct. So we should investigate whether it is. This is what leftist theorists are constantly castigated for thinking, allegedly thinking. What feminists are castigated for thinking. I'm not saying that I'm afraid of the empirical outcome if we were to investigate this. What I am saying is that the decision about which model to investigate has to take account of two things. It has to take kind of the antecedent probability of the model, and I'm going to argue that the antecedent probability, there's no reason to assign the model in philosophy a very high probability, but also the cost of investigation. What happens if you pursue this mode of investigation, if you work on this kind of explanation? So here are some of the costs I see. First of all, despite my effort at showing you that different voices models can be advocated by either people that are sexist or people who are very committed to eliminating sexism, I still think it's the case that claims of gender difference tend to serve reactionary purposes. That's just the kind of use that has been made of them. Now again, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't investigate gender differences if you think they're there. It doesn't mean that you should suppress the findings if you find them. It's just that be aware that when you come out with a claim about gender differences, it's very apt to be put to a purpose that perhaps you didn't intend, but a bad purpose. And one of the reasons I think they're so readily accepted is that claims about gender differences fit antecedent biases. And that means that we're not going to be critical enough when they come forward because we suffer confirmation bias. The things that conform to our antecedent expectations we're less critical of than things that don't. Okay, I also think that the claims about gender differences tend to be understood in the context of two twin fallacies. The first is that if they're gender differences, they must be natural. And the second is that what's natural is immutable. So I think there's both a false kind of essentializing that goes on, and there's a false understanding of what it could possibly mean to say responsibly that something is due to nature. Now, in fact, the nature-nurture opposition is a confusion all on its own, right? It just doesn't make any sense. But to the extent that it makes sense, you might think that it means something like is environmentally invariant or has a mechanism that involves the genotype in some well-understood way. Those are all possible meanings that you could give to natural, but they're not the meanings that people tend to give them. They tend to give them meanings where the term natural has both modal import and also sort of essentialist input. It suggests that if there's a difference in nature between two things, they're really fundamentally of a different kind. Okay, now I also think that stating things in terms of generic expressions is itself problematic because of some things that we know about generic expressions. So generics permit counterexamples. That is, if you, and I'm indebted here to Sarah Jane Leslie in particular, sorry, I'm just blanking on the names. Also Sally McConnell-Genet and Sally Haslinger, who've written a lot about the semantics of generics. Ticks carry Lyme disease is something that every dog owner will say is true, but if you say, well, if you show them 100 ticks and say, oh, these ticks don't have Lyme disease, they'll say, yeah, but ticks carry Lyme disease. So a constraint on the semantics of generics is you have to understand how expressions that, how sentences that look like they're simple generalizations can survive counterexamples so robustly. But they do, which means that if there are not very many women in philosophy, if there are not very many women in engineering or STEM science, that the one or two women that you see who, even if they're doing very well, are not going to necessarily disturb the generic generalization. Okay, so here's some examples. Sarah Jane Leslie, in collaboration with Marjorie Rhodes and Susan Gelman, two developmental psychologists, have shown that there are linguistic cues to the psychological process of essentializing, of seeing of things as that are grouped together as having some kind of hidden, deep property that explains their membership in that group, and that makes them the thing they are. Depending on how you phrase certain generalizations or certain observations, you can encourage or discourage essentializing. Also, I've become interested in generics in comparative contexts, where I think they're very poorly understood. I'm not a linguist, but the small reading I've done suggests that there's a real controversy about how you even superficially assign semantic values to comparative claims. So, for example, let's look at this argument. Men have more upper body strength than women. True. Combat requires upper body strength. True. Therefore, women cannot serve in combat. Now, almost everybody that I give this example to initially says, yeah, that's a good argument. But of course, it's a terrible argument. It's terrible for a bunch of different reasons. One is you can't infer something about the absolute amount of strength that women have and whether or not that's sufficient for serving in combat just from the comparative claim that men have more of it than women do. Now, I recently was talking to a linguist who suggests that the tendency to perform this inference may be purely a pragmatic phenomenon and not have anything to do with the deep, interesting stuff that I'm interested in. That just if you're calling attention to the comparison, to the contrast, it must be because it's a pretty big one. So I'm not so sure about this anymore, but the other thing that I'm interested in is what appears to be a transformation from a scalable property, a degree of strength, to some kind of categorical property, how much strength you actually have. That also seems to be encouraged. So again, it might be just a shallow linguistic phenomenon that has to do with the semantics-pragmatics interface. But even in that case, it would mean that if you're going to frame your account in terms of generics, you're going to set people up for this kind of faulty inference. Okay. Now, I also think that different voices models have historically suffered from serious to gross empirical inadequacies. I don't think I'm really entitled to any inductive generalization here, but I'm going to make one anyway. Different voices models don't pan out. They just don't. So historically, this has been the case. I don't know a single different voices model of explanation that has been vindicated. So, let's look at Carol Gilligan. Well, interestingly enough, there are no gender differences in Kolberg scores, or at least there were not at the time of the meta-analyses done by Jim Rust and Walker and Toma. What they found was that some early data had some what appeared to be gender differences, but if you controlled for educational level, the differences went away. My understanding is that the results of the meta-analyses are that women actually score a little bit higher, but it's not a significant difference. There was also something that was popular in the 80s and 90s for a while called women's ways of knowing that kind of was inspired by Gilligan's work in moral psychology. There was a claim made by Malenki and associates that there were, Brabeck and Larned are the people who reported that there were gendered cognitive differences between women and men in their learning styles and so forth. Malenki claimed that there were serious cognitive and there were cognitive differences between men and women that contributed to there being different sets of strategies for learning that were effective for women and for men, but that turns out not to be the case. Okay, now in particular, the study that I mentioned before, how are we doing on time? Okay. I'm just going to go through this very quickly. There are people in the audience that are much more qualified to do a methodological critique of this particular work. But here are some things that seemed clear to me. That there were serious methodological problems with the arguments that Buck, Walter, and Stitch made for the existence of gender differences in intuitions. The first most serious problem was that it looks like they cherry-picked the data. They wrote to a whole bunch of people who had done surveys about people's reactions to standard philosophical thought experiments, and they just pulled out from the studies the ones in which they found in which a significant gender difference existed. And I think in every case, these were unpredicted differences. They just fell out of the demographic data. So they cherry-picked. And they ignored a whole lot of studies that did not show a difference. Initially, they didn't report these. In a revised version, they mentioned in a footnote that there were a bunch of studies that showed no difference, and they concluded that clearly more research is necessary. There was a problem in many cases with an insufficient sample size, and indeed, in one important instance, Starmans and Friedman, who investigated people's judgments about Gettier cases. This is a little thought experiment about the conditions under which people will attribute knowledge to other people. That when they enlarged their sample size, the effect went away. The significance, when they found significance, it was by item only. So the same study with 14 different items, you'd get a gender difference in one and not in the other 13. That suggests that you really ought to at least look and see if there are artifacts of idiosyncrasies of the items. The other problem is that the data don't support the model that they articulated. If you look at the thought experiments that were surveyed and you look at the patterns of women's and men's judgments in the cases where they had systematically different ones, you found that the women's intuitions were consonant with the philosophical consensus in half of the cases where consensus even exists. So what you had to do is divide up the thought experiments into the ones where there's a philosophical consensus in one direction, the ones where there's a philosophical consensus in the other direction, and then the ones in the middle where there is no philosophical consensus. Like one of the items asked about whether there would be moral responsibility if it turned out that the world is deterministic. Well, philosophers disagree about that. There is no default position. So what they really, in only a third of the cases were the women set up to be subject to the selective mechanism that Buck, Walter, and Stitch posited. Interestingly enough, the discordance was in three cases. This is just nasty on my part. In a case called a violinist, which you detach, it would be morally permissible for you to detach yourself from a violinist who needed your blood to survive for 9 months. And trolley, this is about whether it's morally permissible to divert a runaway trolley from a track where it's going to hit and kill five people to a track where it's going to hit and kill just one person. That's where women were most discordant with what I'm allowing that there's some philosophical consensus in this case, in these cases. Violinist was invented by Judith Jarvis Thompson, and trolley was invented by Philippa Foote. And right now, the leading expert in the world on trolley cases is Francis Kahn, Francis with an E, at Harvard University. So it's really ironic that the discordance that they find is in the cases that women came up with, and that it's in the area of philosophy, ethics, where you find more women than you find in other subdisciplines. Okay, now another thing that was suggested to Buckwalter and Stitch, I think Tanya Lambroso was the person who brought this to Steve Stitch's attention. Probably a lot of you are familiar with the Dweck effect, but maybe I should say a few words about it. Carol Dweck observed that if you have a model of intelligence that says intelligence is a fixed quantity, it's a gift, you got it or you don't have it, there's only a fixed amount of it. When you reach your limit, when you do as much as your particular allotment of intelligence allows you, you can't go any further. You're done after that. That's one model of intelligence. If you have another model of intelligence that says intelligence is a matter of effort and experience and working hard, and that's effort, taking steps to really grasp material, so you have this more dynamic view of intelligence in the first place, and you also think that the effort you put into it makes a difference. Those two models can account for what a student does in the face of some kind of adverse academic experience. So if you're a girl and you've been doing very well in math up to a certain point, and you hit something that is challenging, that you can't get right away, you're going to be more inclined to give up than if you had this effort model where you think, oh, okay, now I have to dig in. I can't, you know, no more doing my homework on the bus. I'm going to have to do it at night now, like other people. And interestingly, Dweck reports that this effect, the effect of the gift model, is most pronounced among academically successful girls. So it's as if they say, okay, I've got a big allotment of smarts, and then they run into something where suddenly, you know, which in their experience is unusual, they can't just do it like that. They have to work at it. They interpret that as having reached their level. Anyway, if you assume that that's the case, Buckwalter and Stitch said, well, that's good for our model, because what we can show is that it's more devastating to girls when they do disagree with the consensus than when they don't agree with the consensus than when they do. So even though it's just a fraction of the cases where women's judgments were discordant with the consensus, those cases are going to have a much more dramatic impact on the individual girls than if they're concordant. Okay, but my point is, if the Dweck effect is real, and if it's present in philosophy, it makes the focus on thought experiments gratuitous, because any negative experience in a philosophy class is going to produce the effect. It doesn't have to just be a discordance in judgment about the thought experiments. Now, there was something that, I don't know, somebody will have to tell me if this is ethical after I do it. If you tell me it's not, then I won't be able to do it. I want to do it. Buckwalter and Stitch, in the first version of their paper, made what I think was a really irresponsible speculation. They said that because of the Dweck effect, we can assume that the women that make it to advanced philosophy classes are not as good as the women who dropped out. Because the women that are really smart and doing well in the philosophy classes, the Dweck effect is going to hit them in the face, they're going to drop out. It's only the ones that are sort of impervious to negative feedback or who weren't doing that well to begin with. Well, they got a lot of flack about this, and they removed it. But I thought it's important that somebody was willing to make that kind of speculation in the context of trying to explain why there are so few women in philosophy. I mean, I thought, whoa, what am I, chop liver? You know, I took a graduate course as an undergraduate. I must be really clueless. which sort of, you know, goes along, I think, with the overall sense that I have that different voices model encourages a bad way of thinking about human difference. Okay, on the other hand, here are the advantages to pursuing the perfect storm model. First of all, we know that the factors that I'm hypothesizing already exist. We don't know, for example, that students whose judgments disagree with the mainstream are apt to be discouraged from doing philosophy. We don't know that that holds, but we do know that there is implicit bias, that there's stereotype threat, and so forth. On the perfect storm model, we don't have to find out whether there are gender differences or not. It's not that we have to say they aren't existent, but we don't have to investigate that question. We don't have to deal with all the methodological difficulties that come with trying to investigate that question. Furthermore, the different voices model is going to have to appeal to some of the same factors anyway. Okay, second thing. I think that if you generalize about women's reactions to thought experiments, you have to be thinking that thought experiments form some kind of a natural kind. I mean, a socially constructed kind, but a kind that has deep things in, where the members have deep things in common with each other. I really don't know how that intuition would get thought through. I mean, is it the presence of questions in the subjunctive mode? Is it a question of hypothesizing, imagining? What is it that unites this set of tasks as being of the same kind? Okay, and then finally, the third advantage I would like to argue the perfect storm model has is that it at least makes clear implications for what the remedy is. It tells us to go ask Greg and other people that actually know the facts, what can we do if these factors are present? What can we do to reduce their impact or eliminate them? Now, why is this a good thing for my model? Well, because those things independently have to be addressed anyway. We've got to do something about those things, whether or not they contribute to a perfect storm. On the other hand, on the DV analysis, it's not clear exactly how this reform of philosophy is supposed to go. What changes are we supposed to make? Very unclear. And in the absence of any clear implications for how we can reform philosophy, in the absence of any clear implications for reform, I think there's a question that opens up that we need to look at. Is it so clear that if women and men have systematically different intuitions about thought experiments, that it's philosophy's fault? Maybe it means that women aren't as good at philosophy as men are. You know, if you had a survey of mathematical intuitions and it turned out that women systematically thought wacky things like there was a largest number or that there are only 14 prime twins or something like that, there's only one size of infinity, you might say, well, there's nothing wrong with mathematics that it makes such weird things true. There's something wrong with women that they can't wrap their heads around this. So I think that if you really are going to pursue the different voices model, you have to at some point consider empirically the question whether the fault lies with philosophy or the fault lies with women. And we know too often in the past, people have been quite prepared to say that the fault lies with women. So that's my brief for the perfect storm as a methodology for answering this question, and I'll be very eager to hear your reactions and corrections and so forth. Thank you.
Questions? Do you want to refill them?
No, you go ahead.
Okay, Monty, yes, I yours first.
So can you say something about why a little bit more about the peculiar, the sui generis nature of philosophy? So it looks like we're disastrously bad compared to, say, law,
yeah,
which also looks really adversarial.
Right.
And the only thing I wasn't sure about exactly how you're addressing it, but you mentioned, you know, superscripts and subscripts,
yes,
and I wasn't sure if that was the bulk of the answer or if there were other features of your account that.
Yeah, so this paper was actually occasioned by an argument that I had with Steve Stitch, where I was saying, look, there's this factor, and every time I mentioned a factor, he'd mention some discipline where that factor was present, and he didn't have a discrimination. That made me think about the situation, the argumentative situation that Kimberly Crenshaw was in. So I was thinking, well, are stereotype threats more likely to erupt for women in philosophy? Is the effect of, there's one kind of thing that I didn't talk about here, I call it somewhat unflatteringly, not unsympathetically, the nerdiness of philosophy, a kind of social norm that men are comfortable being with other men, you know, think about making things in the garage and so forth. I was one of those girls that was hanging out with the guys that were doing science experiments in the garage, and I could sort of pretend that I didn't have any sex up to a point, and then there was no more disguising it. And I noticed this drop off in my how welcome I was in these settings. So there might be things about philosophy in general that make these things either present more often or make them more upsetting, more threatening than they would be in other contexts. So if you compare, for example, if you compare English literature and philosophy, there are many, many more women in literature than there are in philosophy. So they're not going to experience themselves as being in an underrepresented group, so that should tamp down a stereotype threat. It's also not the case in many fields of the humanities that people argue the way philosophers do. And so there are more occasions in which something like conflict or aggression or just intensity can put a woman into a position where she's going to be, if she wants to follow the norm of the discipline, she's going to behave in a way that's going to make people think she's not such a good woman. She's strident, she is not nurturing, she's not warm, and so forth. So we can go through the examples and a couple of more that I discuss in the paper. But that's the plan, to show that there's some particular, there's a sui generis interaction effect, not a sui generis form of discrimination.
So to Stitch, you say, Stitch says back, look, both English and law didn't have very many women 50 years ago, just like philosophy. Now both English and law look like they're doing pretty good compared to philosophy, and law's really adversarial. Also, but they're doing okay, and then you say, but there's this other thing about philosophy, and then you say, but English isn't so adversarial, and they're doing, and then you say, there's this other, is that the...
Yeah, so if you wonder about law in particular, what I have to do is I have to find a difference between philosophy and law so that the anomaly is explained. Why don't you get women threatened by, why don't you get... if something about the adversarial model is a factor, why doesn't it work equally in law and in philosophy? I don't have an explanation for that completely, but there are a couple of differences. One is that admissions to law schools are based much more highly on so-called objective measures. You know, your LSAT scores, your GPA, the prestige of the institution that you went to. And if women are doing equally well on those indicators, they're likely to be admitted into law school in the same numbers. Whereas, you know, the evaluation of a student's dossier applying to graduate school is going to be subject to, there are just lots of opportunities for these various kinds of bias to enter in, both in the production of the opinions that people have about the young woman and in the evaluations that the evaluators will bring to it. Also, my impression is that law is not as adversarial as philosophy is, that certainly some law school classes, especially elite institutions, there's this kind of philosophical discourse that's encouraged. But an awful lot of law is not, I mean, very, very little law now is actually arguing things in court, so there might be that the opportunities for success are not tied very closely to one's ability to do these kinds of adversarial maneuverings as they are in philosophy. But that would be the form of the answer anyway. With some suggestions.
Just lots of hands up. Stacey, you're next.
So I wanted to ask about how these two models deal with intersectionality.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm primarily thinking of is I just saw Rachel McKinnon give a paper on stereotype threat and how it affects trans women in philosophy. And one of her main implications that came out of her paper was that it seems like gender essentialism is doing a lot of pernicious work in a sense, almost like multiplying the stereotype threat that people like trans women can face because of, right, what the things that you mentioned, like how we think of these differences as being natural and mutually exclusive, and right, so if some things are masculine that are tied up with philosophy, that then if women can do that, that there's something extra masculine about those women,
uh-huh.
and then when you have social
yeah.
identities that are presented so along gender identity, sexuality, and race even, I think, that are then almost like, they're, you know, like women that aren't quite as feminine as
yeah.
like the cisgender straight
yeah.
white women. You have all this other stuff going on.
Yeah.
And it, at first I wanted to say, oh, it looks like the perfect storm model can do a better job of dealing with those issues, but I'm actually not, I don't know, I'm not quite sure. So I was wondering if you had thought about that.
Okay, yeah, so my abstract model for the structure of discrimination is that you've got various axes. You've got a race axis, you've got a disability, level disability axis, you've got a gender axis, you've got an ethnicity axis, as many axes as you want, and then your social location is a certain point in that multidimensional space. So a white person has race, right? It's just not going to have... The white person's overall life prospects are not going to be conditioned in the same way by their race that that a black person's life prospects are going to be conditioned by their race. So then you can think of, you can handle intersectionality, I think, very, very neatly. I mean, it's sort of set up to do that. You just think of racism and sexism as vectors, and you add the vectors together and you get a position in logical, in the multidimensional space. I was thinking of it on the model of mass and velocity. We cannot measure velocity directly or mass directly because things that have mass always come with some velocity. So they're not substantively separable, but they are analytically separable. In the same way, I want to say you're not materially separable from your race or from your sexuality or your presenting sexuality or any of these things that are features of you. We can't just take a bunch of women and abstract from all the different things that differentiate them and say, now we've got a theory of womanhood. No, you can only think of, I think the only way to think of it is that being a woman has a certain kind of systematic effect on the individuals that are identified that way or are women, depending on how you think women works. Does that help?
Yeah.
How does your model help in evaluating Larry Summers' contribution and why there are fewer women?
Oh, well, okay. I think Larry Summers got kind of a bad rap about that, but on the other hand, I think he made a lot of mistakes that were not seized on. So one of the things he said was that, and Steve Pinker has referred to the same data in an online debate he did with Elizabeth Spelke. Summers said, look, women are just doing what they want to do. That's a big part of the explanation for why there's so few women in science. Women prioritize family and friends above career advancement, right? Well, if you think of what people decide to do as expressive of some deep, intrinsic, inalterable feature of them, then you're going to say women are just naturally inclined to put their families above their careers, right? But if you look at it in a more dynamic way and you say, well, what are the choices that face women and men? In most cases, for a woman to put her career first is to significantly reduce the probability that she'll be able to have a family, to have children. It still is the case, even in parts of this country where there are some progressive family leave policies, it still has a much bigger impact on a woman's career to have children than it does on a man's career. Furthermore, data that my colleague Nancy Fulbray in economics has show that the consequences for a woman of sitting out a couple of years in the job market are just catastrophic. She just never regains. She can't re-enter at the point that she left in terms of her career ladder. Well, you know, if those are the choices, if that's the way your choice situation is structured, it can be just a plain old rational decision to say, well, I'm gonna devote myself to family and my affective relations. I mean, that's just a smart decision to make. So the mistake I think Summers makes is that he sort of reifies and essentializes this preference and doesn't ask where does the preference come from. The other thing is, suppose that it is natural, right? Does that mean we have to say, oh, well, we can't do anything about it, or we shouldn't do anything about it? A lot of little boys don't like to read. They don't like to read, I'm told, because they have a condition called dyslexia, which is some kind of information processing problem. We don't say, well, they don't want to read, they can't read, it's hard for them to read, we'll just let them not read. No, we say it is socially absolutely vital in this day and age for kids to learn how to read. We have to alter the curriculum, we have to give extra resources to this, we have to do whatever it takes, right? Well, if women are really that way about their careers, and if having certain kinds of careers really is necessary for being a sort of full-fledged person, then we ought to intervene, whether it's natural or not. So that's what I'd say to Larry Summers. Where is he?
Yes, I wanted to ask a question about the pipeline problem, because mm-hmm. you asked why there's so few women in philosophy. You presented the numbers on faculty and then the numbers on PhDs, which weren't that different. But I wonder if the pipeline for faculty is PhDs, but the pipeline for PhDs is philosophy majors.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how different the numbers are there, but it strikes me that...
Actually, there's some recent data on that.
Okay. It strikes me that that would be a very interesting empirical question. I wonder how your model might look different if the question that we're asking is, why do so few women choose to major in philosophy? One reason I ask this is because I've got a 19-year-old daughter. She's just finished her first year in college, announced to me that she's majoring in philosophy.
Cool. Now,
she's got a dad for a philosopher. We've been doing trolley problems over dinner, you know, forever, and I taught her logic when she was 12. So, I mean, she's probably an outlier, but there probably got to be different stories that people have about why they choose mm-hmm. their major, and that would seem to be a point at which empirical work really zero.
Absolutely. And I have to say there's some very strong evidence that there's a huge hole in the pipeline between the first and second philosophy classes. So Valerie Tiberius, Carrie Figdor, and Molly Paxton did a study that was sponsored by the Society for Philosophy and Psychology and the American Philosophical Association. They just got enrollment data from Sally, you remember how many was it? It's well over 100.
They did both universities
and colleges. They got a response rate, I think it was about 50%, which was supposed to be not bad for survey research. If that's bad for survey research, then they got more than that. I'm just misremembering. But what they discovered was that there's a huge drop off. I mean, of the people that take first philosophy courses, a small percentage of them take second courses in philosophy. But the drop-off for women is much greater, substantially, significantly greater than for men. They also found something sort of tantalizing, which was that when they looked at the rate of drop-off and the number of women on the faculty at these institutions, they found that having more women faculty somewhat mitigated the drop-off. They don't know why that is. They don't know that the women faculty were teaching the introductory courses. They don't know if these students were seeing these women. And, you know, in the way American universities are organized, you probably, as a first-year student, you might not know who the other faculty are in that department. So, you know, there are lots of questions about what exactly the mechanism is and what that says about all of this. I think that Eddie Namias is doing some work on, I think he's doing some focus group work and some other things to try to figure out what's going on with that stuff.
I saw a quick follow-up finger.
Yeah, so there's a paper that just came out of GSU called Why Is It Goodbye at Hello? Where some students and faculty looked at,
that's
and did a ton of survey with, I think it was people in their introduction to philosophy classes, right? So going off on this pipeline problem. And my crude summary of it is some of the things that they looked at is like the actual instructor in the class didn't seem to matter, but people's perceptions, I believe, of like, how many women were in the department, how many women were in that faculty, how many women were sort of like available as role models mm-hmm. did matter. And they also found that some of the problems seemed to be that women, and also they looked at, I believe, black students or racially marginalized groups, didn't feel comfortable in philosophy, didn't think that they were quite as good at it. But one of the really interesting things was like, even when those students sort of felt like they were on par with the other people in that class, they had different schemas for like people in that intro to philosophy class with them and then philosophy majors.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of they weren't identifying themselves uh-huh. with like the kinds of people
yeah.
who would be philosophy majors.
Yeah, that's Eddie Namias' group's work. Yeah.
Did you have a question?
Yeah. I'm a little bit confused. There's a term that you used about
I feel your pain.
You started out by saying that there was something wrong with philosophy. And everything you've kind of...
That's an element of the different voices model.
Yeah. I have no idea what you're talking about. And the other question I have has to do with, if you would clarify what you mean by adversarial, that was the word I was going to make a minute ago. Because to me, philosophy is more about dialogue and communication. It may be adversarial, but not in the same sense that you might find in a courtroom or in the business community. There are more women that go to law school than men these days, I understand. And I think there are a number of, the percentage of women going to getting MBAs is also getting, if it's not equal, it's probably higher, it's very close. So in both of those, they're very competitive and very adversarial, in a way that I think that philosophy isn't.
I'd
like to have you clarify that, if you would.
Well, I didn't make the proposal. It was Janice Moulton's proposal, but a lot of people seem to agree with her. And what she had in mind really was the legal sense of adversarial, where we try, where the background assumption is that we'll get at the truth if we get two advocates each doing the best they can for an opposite point of view. If we let them just sort of battle it out, the truth will kind of emerge. And we do that a lot. I do that a lot in philosophy. It doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be competitive, and it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be aggressive or unpleasant. It's just that there's a kind of focus on what's wrong with that position that you don't find in other fields. If that's not your impression of philosophy, that's fine. And you know, one of the problems with
but that's just thinking.
Well, no. I mean, I was. I've been at a number of interdisciplinary humanities institutes. And my sense is that the conversation, and I've been at talks where an English professor gives a talk in a philosophy department, and my and their experience is that just the norms about asking questions are very different. The direct challenge to the speaker's thesis, the way we would just say it's just thinking, they find aberrant. But again, my view wasn't that there's a standing characteristic to philosophy that makes it makes women find it alienating. I was suggesting that there are a bunch of different things that might be true of philosophy that might interact with other things that are affecting women to produce this kind of interaction effect, or that things that are forms of discrimination forms of discrimination that are present in a lot of places might be more intense in philosophy. I'm sorry if the examples didn't help. That's
great.
Yeah, I just wanted to add a point to this discussion about adversarial, which comes from social psychology. A core aspect of social psychology and a core aspect of straight-edge prep involves the notion of subject and construal, the notion that things are the way that we construe them to be, and we can differ in how we construe them to be. So one cause of inequality in schooling can be objective, different treatment. For example, people may give some students more time to answer questions than other students. But stereotype threat is an explanation that focuses on the best kinds of schools where there isn't such objective inequality. It suggests that even in these schools, the subjective experience of school can be different. So the teacher who says, I'm giving you a test, this test is going to evaluate your abilities, might be objectively non-biased in any way. They could conceivably be, and yet that statement may be heard and felt differently by different students. So, in terms of adversarial, it's just a useful distinction to think about. So the substantive nature of the adversarial dialogue or non-adversarial dialogue that may or may not happen in philosophy, and the experience of those same conversations and how that may be felt differently by people who contend with stereotypes and underrepresentation, stereotypes about logic and abstract reasoning and so forth and so on, and those who don't.
But I've seen it happen several times that when this is the details in the paper, that this is based on three actual anecdotes, that women criticizing men's philosophical view at a paper or a conference or something, doing it perfectly normally and reasonably by disciplinary standards, but still making it clear that a mistake has been made. then get disarmed by the guy they're criticizing by his sexualizing the encounter. So in one case, there was a woman, I was out to dinner with a few people after a presentation, and a young woman who's a junior faculty member was pursuing a criticism she hadn't gotten a chance to adequately develop in the question and answer session, happened to be her senior, one of her senior colleagues who was doing it. And, you know, she nailed him, but she was being much nicer about it than I would have been. She was being, you know, perfectly fine about it. And he was looking at her the whole time, and as she finished, he turns around, he looks to me, and he says, so-and-so has no idea how sexy she is when she argues like that.
But that happens in any...
Here's my point. She was perfectly conforming to the norm of conversation. Well, I'm not sure you do, excuse me. She was conforming to the norm that is the advertised and the followed norm for men in philosophy, and what this guy did was he made it not a philosophy context. He really, I'm grateful to Greg who gave that as an example of one of the ways in which stereotype can be evoked. He made her conscious of being a woman. And there's no reason for that.
Exactly. But that happens in any occupation.
No, but it doesn't necessarily if the men don't feel that they're in some kind of an adversarial relationship with the woman. So in literature, it might not happen.
But that has nothing to do with philosophy. It has to do...
Okay, well, we just...
Excuse me, but Tamara, you had a question?
Yeah, I wonder whether there's an additional contributing factor to The Perfect Storm, which you might think of as mid-50s musical chairs plus tipping point plus alternative gravitational locus. Those are the follows, right? Post-war American academia didn't have enough women to go around for all the sociological reasons that we understand. They got distributed among the various disciplines in a way that their musical chairs weren't quite enough to go around. The result of that is that some of the disciplines, in part as the result of a particularly powerful single figure in them, began to develop critical mass.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that happened to philosophy is that a lot of the adjacent disciplines did that. So, for example, linguistic semantics draws a large number of women who might otherwise major in philosophy. Political theory draws a large number of women who might otherwise major in philosophy. Some parts of theoretical literary theory draw a large number of women who might otherwise major in philosophy. So one piece of evidence in favor of that hypothesis as part, not full, but as part of the explanation, would be to look and see in the ringing disciplines, first of all, do women who end up in those disciplines start out by taking a certain number of philosophy courses as undergrad? And two, do they end up working at the philosophical edge of the surrounding discipline? If so, that might be part of the explanation. I don't have a solution, but part of what we're trying to do is a story.
Several linguists and psychologists have suggested that there were founder effects. And also in psychology, this is according to Sue Carey and Liz Felke and a couple of other women psychologists. There was a kind of ghettoization of women working on babies and animals, and then it turned out that there's a whole lot of interesting stuff going on in developmental and ethology. So there they were dominating the field. I think that could very, very well be a factor.
Just connected to this, I think you can add the issue of schemas and narratives. So as a given the stereotypical philosopher as, you know, the Socratic sort of half-naked, bearded man, that there are, it's easier to find ways of telling a narrative about yourself. So this connects to the intro-level stuff.
Uh-huh.
Telling a narrative about how you can become a linguist, because women are good at languages, or how you can become a political theorist, because they don't quite have that same half-naked man in a toga sort of dimension. And so if you can tell that story, there's a schema that opens up that narrative for you. It's going to be easier to enter into it and then try and do the philosophy on the side or something.
Mm-hmm.
That's just
thanks for that.
Before you talk about women in philosophy too court, I'd like to see some comparative studies. First of all, I think you're certainly confining yourself to Western philosophy, but let's say we stick ourselves to that.
It's worse in continental philosophy, European continental philosophy.
But most of your examples were American. You gave a little bit of a British example. But if you think about the well-known distinction between Anglophone and Western and continental philosophy, right. There are big differences there.
Yeah, it's worse
and
in continental.
A lot of continental women philosophers, it's not clear to me, like, for example, that the problems that Simone de Beauvoir or Hannah Arendt or Agnes Heller face are the same as the problems that American women philosophers face.
I'm sure they're not.
So shouldn't you do a comparative study?
Well, I don't have...
Or else add American to women and philosophy?
Well, I'm happy to do that for Anglophone. I actually have New Zealand and Australia data reported in the paper, and I don't have the data reported in the paper, but it exists. It's much worse in Europe. The gender disparity is much worse in Europe, even among people who study there's more gender bias.
Whether it's better or worse, is the basis the same or different?
Well, now,
if the basis is the same, then you can kind of speak about women and philosophy. If the basis is different, then you'd have to restrict yourself.
Yeah, so it's supposed to be a virtue of my model that there's no substantive content to sexist discrimination. It's discrimination along a parameter. Just as there's no substantive facts about mass per se that you can separate from the observations, it's supposed to be a virtue of my approach that we can account for why sexist discrimination in one society or one historical period looks different from sexist discrimination in another society or another period.
But it can make a big difference. This is an example from a different field.
I'm not denying that.
During Soviet times, I know somebody who was a correspondent in Moscow.
Right.
His son went to a Russian school. And when they asked him when he wanted to be, grew up, he said he wanted to be a doctor. And all the boys said, oh, that's for girls.
Right, yeah.
So
okay, that's
totally different from the American boys.
Yes, of course. But what's the case? What's the case is that being a physician was not as prestigious
exactly.
a job.
Exactly.
Okay, right. So there's your gender discrimination. The effect of gender discrimination is not to say substantively, you can't do this, you can't do that, but to say in any given society, whatever the devalued positions are, that's where the women are going to get concentrated.
France,
so we're not disagreeing.
I suspect in France, philosophy has a much higher status.
That's right, and there are more men, as my model predicts.
Any other questions? Last one?
So I guess this would be something that would be a little more difficult.
A little bit louder, please.
Sorry. This would be something that would be more difficult to study, but so I was actually, one of Eddie Nani's.
Oh, cool.
The study with Morgan Tony. And I remember, I taught at Georgia State for a year, so all the master's students have to. And I remember talking to women that were particularly good in my class that ended up not majoring in philosophy about why they didn't. And, the sort of like, people don't like to talk about it, but the reason that I got in 5 out of 6 cases was that the undergraduate male population that majored in philosophy were just insufferable as the people to be around. And so...
I did not say that, just for the record. It was not me.
And so, like, I just don't think that that's... It wasn't something that I had thought about prior to talking to them about it, but then sort of I became conscious of the classroom atmosphere and seeing, especially even... taking graduate level classes with Tony and Morgan, who worked with Eddie, it was the same thing where they never talked at all. And it was because of the specific classroom dynamic. Because there's a sort of, there is a sort of, regardless of whether philosophy itself is adversarial in the kind of in the normative sense, it certainly functions that way in a classroom context most of the time.
Yeah.
In talking to him, that was.
Yeah, but the thing that I want to emphasize is that I'm not claiming that philosophy is adversarial in the way that Janice Moulton was claiming. I'm not saying that that's true of all philosophy, and certainly some very great philosophers were as unadversarial as you could get. Jack Rawls was just perfectly mannered and generous with all. But insofar as some kind of adversarial back and forth thing is valued, the ability to do that is valued, that's not going to have a uniform effect on women. It's not that the women who are comfortable with that will do fine and the women who aren't comfortable with that will not do fine. It's got a negative effect on both kinds of women because the woman who does that, I'm speculating, is not acting the way a woman should. And the woman who doesn't do that is not meeting the disciplinary norm. So one way or other, you're going to be some kind of a monster. Or you're either going to be a monster, you're going to destroy the merits of your sex, or you're going to just not be very good at philosophy. So that's the part that I'm not committed to saying philosophy is adversarial, but I'm saying if there are practices and norms that have that character, my model says it's going to have different effects depending on the personalities and the interests and the styles that women bring to it.
All right, let's thank our speaker again. We'll just take a 1 minute break. There's some refreshments in the back. If you'd like to grab it, and we'll transition to our next speaker.
I just wanted to say you can distinguish UMass.
Excuse me, I have to get. I have to concentrate on this so that I can get out of here. I have to rush off to another talk. So.
Oh.
I cannot do.
Well, I'll explain to you anytime you want what the difference between mass and velocity is. One is dynamic, the other is kinematic.
I really can't. I want to hear what you're saying, but I can't do that while I'm trying to do this. I'm sorry.